Welcome to the Iowa Basketball Podcast, the Big Control Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. No Matt Moore today. He's either sick or dead. I'm not sure which one, but I've got a guest on the line, Skyping with me, Dan Devine of Ball Don't Lie on Yahoo.com. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Zach. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being pressured into coming on. That my little Twitter ruse worked.
I have a really weak constitution, and I'm very easily frightened, so that was a perfect way to get at me.
I was banking on that, to be honest with you. I picked that up. I just figured, like, at All-Star Weekend, I felt like I could pressure you into at least one thing in life, and it was going to be getting on this podcast.
I mean, I guess I'm just really lucky that that was what you decided to use that chip on. But sure. Yeah, it worked out. It seems to have worked out well for both of us.
How did you like All-Star Weekend? Was this your first, or have you been there before?
It was my first time going out to it. It's cool. It's a little bit hard to process at first. I mean, it's a weird weekend in that things sort of get easier and slower as it goes on.
Yeah.
Because you start out, as you saw when we were out there, you start out on that, that Friday morning with the big media day sessions, and like everybody's talking. You have the rookie sophomore game, the Rising Stars Challenge, excuse me. There, everybody's talking. The people from the All-Star Saturday Night events, the All-Star teams themselves, and it's just like session after session after session. So you have to go from like 0 to 60 right away and just start jamming a recorder in people's faces and trying to think of something clever to say. So that was like a big shock to the system, but it was fun. Houston was cool. I mean, I didn't get to do a ton of exploring or a ton of digging into the city culture because of working, but it was a blast. I'd love to do that again.
Yeah, that was one thing I found myself in the media session when the Western All-Stars were out there, was I was standing in the middle of the room and I like was turning to see the next easiest place to go to, and they were all filled with people asking questions, and I literally just did a 360 and ended up in the same like direction of vision that I had previously. I was like, oh, I don't know what to do here.
Yeah, no, it was really, I mean, because it's tough. Like, you have, yes, you're like in that room, you're totally supposed to go talk to Kobe Bryant, right?
Right?
Like, he's the biggest thing there. He's the most, famous and successful guy there. Your job should be like to go try to talk to him. But there's 300 people around him around a small table in a corner. And you have to like elbow your way through a bunch of Belgian dudes to try to get near him and ask him to, and not ask him anything because people are already asking him all the questions. So, or you can kind of like go see if you can sign up next to Zach Randolph for 5 minutes
right,
and see what happens. And that was a lot of fun. That kind of thing I had a really good time with, because they were guys that, you actually got to have a little bit of a conversation with, like a guy that was, maybe a little bit, lower on the totem pole celebrity-wise. I wound up talking to a lot of the guys that were there for the first time.
Yeah.
Where with their first All-Star game, because there were six dudes from the West and James Harden. Six dudes from the East and James Harden. You got to actually, like, crack a joke with Drew Holiday, like, find out a little bit more about these guys. So that was kind of cool, but you did blow an opportunity, it felt like, by being sort of paralyzed when everybody started flooding around LeBron.
Yeah, I liked it when it was just the Saturday night contestants, because I found myself just staring at Sam Cassell while he was talking. That was really cool. And I feel like I might have creeped him out at one point, because I was just standing there just smiling because everything he said was entertaining to me. And I wasn't a total creep. I did ask him a couple of questions and had a cool conversation with him about like being ready to contribute as a young player and all this stuff. But there was a point where I thought, I've been standing next to him for 10 minutes and I'm just smiling.
Yeah. I think I did the same thing with Kenneth Faried.
Yeah.
The first time that I, the first session, the first thing was that Friday morning, and it was right after or during like the practices for Team Chuck versus Team Shaq, which, as I'm sure you saw, was a really, really kind of hard-nosed, grinded-out practice. Those guys were really going at it for a good 7 to 9 minutes. But then afterward, they brought them all sort of off to the back, backside of the basketball court they had set up, and had like director's chairs set up behind a fence.
Yeah.
So it was like you were watching an arena rock band, but you had to like have a little barrier between for people who were trying to stage dive.
Right.
And so Kenneth Faried was just sitting there in a director's chair with people around him, and I was like, oh, I could probably just sit here and listen to this guy talk and like tell little jokes and be off, a little off-putting, and, or I'm sorry, a little disarming and charming and things like that. I could listen to this for about 10 minutes, and then you realize you only have about 5 minutes left in the session, and you'd have to go try to talk to other people.
Right.
It's good to get that over with early, though. Like, to get that, you know, like, oh, I just got my creep thing out of the way real quick. Good. Thank goodness. I can just go about the rest of my business.
It's always good to get rid of that creepy feeling the first day. Because if you wait till, like, Saturday or Sunday, it can really hurt you. And I actually, not a creepy thing, but I knocked into LeBron James on his way out to the floor on All-Star Sunday. I would just happen to be talking to someone, walking down the hallway. He came out of the locker room, and we literally bumped shoulders, and I had to back off because, one, he's a lot larger than me, and, two, I didn't want to get kicked out. But that was an odd moment for me.
Yeah, I would imagine so. You kind of just don't really have any place to go but backward.
Right.
You hit into him. I'm glad that you didn't wind up getting any sort of injury from that, because I was like, the most terrifying thing that I saw that weekend was Dominique Wilkins walking in reverse and back into a child. I was at one of the hotels. I just finished talking to somebody, and I was coming out of the elevator, and he was backpedaling into the elevator, and there was a kid that was in front of me walking out of the elevator, and Dominique Wilkins just, thankfully he didn't step lively, you know, like high and lively.
Yeah.
He sort of bumped into him, because the kid, I mean, couldn't have been much higher than like his kneecap. So if he would have like actually taken a big step, he might have rocked this kid. But thankfully, I mean, it's the kind of thing that makes you realize, especially like older NBA players that have put on some weight, should totally come with a truck siren, you know, like the beep beep beep.
Sure.
Backup truck siren, because otherwise someone can get really hurt if no one's paying attention.
I have no way to transition into this, so it's going to be super awkward. But speaking of paying attention, you write for a blog that people pay attention to. The Ball Don't Lie is a very good blog. You're very good at it. You've got a good team, and you wrote something recently about Tony Parker, which received a little bit of backlash.
Well, first of all, before we get into that, I just want to say, I don't know what you're talking about that you didn't have a good segue, because that was about as smooth and natural a transition.
I gotta be honest, halfway into it, it felt pretty professional.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of felt good as it was leaving your hand, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You were on point with it. Thank you for the kind words about the blog. It's at yahoosports.com, balldontlie.com. People can check that out. Last week, obviously, Thursday night was a big game in the league with, the Spurs taking on the Clippers, and it was, two big teams out west with two of the top point guards in the league, and Tony Parker just destroyed Chris Paul. Like, he came out and,
yeah,
you know, did whatever he wanted, got wherever he wanted on the floor. I think it was like something like 31 points and 7 assists with no turnovers, and like, he was just everywhere, and the Spurs totally blew out the Clippers, and Paul had a terrible game. And because it was a national TV game, because it was a TNT game, and because it was, you know, a high-profile thing, people started talking about Tony Parker and saying, you know, like, is Tony Parker an MVP candidate? And that's awesome. Like, that's great.
Sure.
It's a great discussion to have, because that guy deserves, you know, he's been playing amazing. I think he was fourth in the league in PER after that game. He's, you know, been sensational for the last month. But if you're going to say that Tony, like, you could say that Tony Parker maybe is a more deserving MVP candidate than Chris Paul. You can make an argument, I guess. But you can't say that he's the MVP of the league like Charles Barkley did and like some other people did that night, because the two guys named LeBron James and Kevin Durant exist.
Like, they haven't retired.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Wow, that's a pretty big story. We should probably start writing about that.
I have to check with my sources, but they may have retired already, or maybe they haven't. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, after watching Parker's performance last Thursday, they decided to hang them up.
Exactly.
And that does not strike me as a particularly like hot sports takes kind of opinion to say, no, this dude is awesome and he's super, super good and he's playing at a career peak kind of level, and you can prove that with numbers. You can prove it with eyeball stuff. It's easy to see that. But he's also not one of the two best players in the league right now, and he's not one of the two most valuable players to his team, as valuable as he is to the Spurs. And I wrote that. And I think the headline was even something very conciliatory like that. Like, Tony Parker's awesome, but he's not the MVP, and
yeah,
that's okay.
Right.
Like, I want to put this out right in front of people immediately to let them know, like, I am not coming here to disparage Tony Parker. I'm just trying to add a little context to the conversation. And the response I got from it, to a large extent, was like, can't believe you and the rest of the media keeps hating on Tony Parker. Why does nobody want to appreciate and respect this great, great man? And I was kind of like, oh, okay, this is the thing where you just have to kind of give up. Like, oh, I thought I did a pretty decent job of this, but maybe I didn't do such a hot job. I don't know.
Well, that's a well. I thought you did an excellent job with it. The weird thing is that people say people want like MVP discussion is the validation for a player having a good season, and people say, well, he should be in the discussion. It's like, yes, because you do have to give out third, fourth, and fifth place votes. So technically, yeah, I guess he is in the discussion. But in terms of like, should he win the MVP? That seems asinine to me because, like you said, LeBron James and Kevin Durant still exist, and they're pretty good and they're pretty valuable, and it's really between them. And even as much as you want to like, as much as I want to praise Chris Paul and you know keep worshiping to the shrine that I've built in the second bedroom in my apartment to him, it feels like it's dumb to say, hey, he's been as valuable as these other two super talented, super productive guys who just dominate games for their very good teams. And it makes me wonder, why isn't like the All-NBA team a sexier award for guys? Is it because it's not an individual thing because they give it out to 15 guys? Because it seems like you could make the argument, hey, Tony Parker should be an All-NBA first teamer. And there's his validation for a great season, but no one really seems to care that much about the award.
Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it. I mean, it's one of the weird things where it comes up in conversation. You know, when a guy is toward the end of his career or when he's retired, like this guy was an 11-time All-Star,
right?
But you don't really hear that quite as much about how many All-NBA teams he's made, especially not first whether he made seven straight All-NBA first teams, even though that would seem to be a more a greater accomplishment because, all kind of stuff can happen with All-Star games, whether it's fan voting or injury replacements or things like that. All-NBA voting happening after the season and being the kind of thing that's, where you're selecting, these are the five guys that have the best seasons of anybody in this, in this league. At that time, it seems like that would be a higher, would offer a higher level of validation for the type of work somebody put in over the course of a year. But I think, yeah, the fact that it's not, and that's not an individual award. The fact that it doesn't result in like some kind of that there's not a larger amount of emphasis put on it from a media perspective, especially. I mean, we talk about that, and there's inevitably who got snubbed and who got who should have been on which level or which tier of the All-NBA team, but it doesn't seem to carry the same weight, and it's weird because I think you're absolutely right. You can look at it like there are, maybe 15, 20 guys in the league that are, above and beyond the remainder of the other players in the league. There are probably 10 that are at that, elite or near elite level. And then you're talking about greats and who at their individual position and with their respective responsibilities has had the biggest impact. And that's a more interesting conversation to me. But it does wind up introducing, some, shades of gray and nuance into it. And it's easier just to get mad. Like, that's the thing that's a bummer, but it's also it's a truth. It's easier just to get mad than it is to start figuring out, acknowledging that we can have, room in our heads and hearts for all of this stuff.
Right.
And, I'd rather just get mad if you think a thing that's different than the thing that I think right away. And I don't know. I think it's part of what we have to deal with, and you kind of want to try to add some more context and a little bit more opportunity to think about all that stuff when you write. But it's all you can't. It's sports. People aren't going to think rationally about it all the time.
Which for me is frustrating because it's the one area of my life that I try to stay rational about. And you make an interesting point about it's just easier to get mad. I tweeted out during the All-Star break, because this is a humble brag, Roy Hibbert still follows me. He's followed me since the summer, and he allegedly thinks I'm funny, which is really cool for me because he's on TV. So I said, I tweeted out something like, oh, what are the odds that next year Roy Hibbert is becomes an All-Star again, and I get to hang out with him all weekend, and we become best friends. And it was something like, "What's that? It's not going to happen." Never mind. And someone was like, "Why the hate for Roy Hibbert?" And I was like, "How do you possibly get hatred out of what I just said? Like, I just said I wanted to hang out with him. I want him to be an All-Star and hang out with him." And they're like, "You don't think he can be an All-Star?" I was like, "Well, maybe I didn't phrase it correctly, but that's not." It was more the chances of me being friends with him aren't going to happen. And it's weird, like, that instant reaction of find a way to spin it to where this guy doesn't like my guy.
Yeah, well, first, I would say the first thing that I'd say is don't sell yourself short, Zach. I think there's a real chance that that you know, you can wind up spending, you know, at least maybe sharing a meal or
yeah,
something with
Roy Hibbert. He did retweet a joke about Dante Jones that I had. That was cool.
Well, I mean, it's about finding someone's comedic wheelhouse, really. And sure. I think we can fairly say that sure. Dante Jones jokes is where Roy Hibbert lives. But beyond that, yeah, I don't know what the genesis of it is. I don't know if it's that it was like this is sort of the way that sports talk culture has been for forever, or it's. I mean, there's also the element of everyone seems to go on Twitter looking to be upset at things, whether it's you know, responding to someone else's joke they didn't like, or looking for confirmation about a particular perspective that they have,
sure.
And then looking for those who you know sort of go a different way from it and looking to get into an argument. And it seems like a bummer of a way to spend your time, but it seems like a way a lot of people dig it. And I don't know. I think that there's people invest. I love the level of passion people invest in, you know, supporting their chosen team or the particular player that they love or whatever. Like
sure.
that's awesome and can manifest in really cool and positive stuff.
Yeah, we have jobs because of it.
Exactly, right. Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough to be able to talk to you in the middle of the day because people dig this stuff enough to where someone's willing to pay me to do it as a job. Like,
right.
That's amazing, and I'm appreciative of that.
Right.
It's just like, I mean, maybe the good thing, it's a good thing because it allows people to get some of the toxic stuff in their brains out in a different, you know, like in a relatively innocuous context.
Yeah.
But then you see stuff, I mean, it can manifest itself in really weird ways and negative ways where you've got people like, freaking out about to a coach's kid on Twitter about a bad call that he made, or like, you know, issuing death threats to someone's wife because he missed a corner three, and that's the extreme end of that stuff. But a lot of it comes from the same place, which is like, I want this thing to go well so that I can enjoy something in my downtime, and I want validation for the thing that I care about. And when I don't get it, I sort of turn in a negative direction, and that's that kind of, I mean. You wish there was a little bit more perspective on it. Thankfully, no one, you know, like, wished a pox on my house for saying that Tony Parker wasn't the first place, deserving first place vote getter for MVP. But, a lot of people seem to not like the level to which I said he was awesome.
I find it unlikely that nobody wished a pox on your house because I've seen the Yahoo comments before. And those are, that's a dark place.
The best readership on the internet. I'm blessed to have the readership that I do, and it's a wonderful place to be. It's an absolutely wonderful place to read.
Sure, no, it is a great place to read. Just don't scroll too far down on the page. At least maybe that would be my suggestion, and not yours.
I think it would definitely not be my suggestion, and I have no problem that you made it.
Okay, you mentioned trying to add nuance and. That's a weird balance to find because you want to get the information out there being an NBA blogger. You also want to add a little bit of your take and personality to it. You want to try to find a balance between, you know, what you see on the court and maybe respect for certain statistics. How do you try to find that balance? Is it just you trust your own voice or you trust the feedback you're getting? Because I find that to be a very strange dynamic to try to balance everything.
Yeah, no, it's. I think that makes sense. It's hard, especially like I'm pretty still relatively new at doing this, you know, as my primary thing. Like,
yeah.
I mean, we sort of came up in the same time frame of starting to write blog posts about
yeah.
basketball and make jokes and stuff. But as far as me trying to get a little more or being able to do it full time and being able to do it a little more seriously, like I'm by no means like one of the sharpest, most incisive minds about the X's and O's of the game. So it's like, that's hard work for me, like trying to break down plays or really make sure I understand sets and what teams are trying to do and things like that.
Can I just offer up a quick tip? I feel the same way about my ability to do that, but if you just pretend that you know what you're talking about, people seem to buy it.
Yeah, it's fake it till you make it, right? And
right.
Then eventually someone starts suggesting that you're an expert on something,
right.
Which I don't think that's anywhere. I think we both of us maybe have a little bit of time before we get there, but it's a good pro tip to suggest that we
sure.
just pretend.
Sure.
But I think there's sort of naive to suggest that you don't need to watch because you can just get whatever you want to get out of stats. And it's naive to suggest that the stats, especially the advanced metrics and stuff, don't actually matter or don't tell you anything because you can learn everything that you want to know by watching the game. And thankfully, I mean, that seems like that's like an argument that existed a lot 2 years ago on both sides of the sort of aisle, like the people that were super into advanced metrics saying, you know, your eyes will lie to you, and then the people that just, you know, wanted to watch the game saying this saps all the fun out of the game. And now it seems like we've come to kind of a middle ground, which is cool. Like, you can just watch it. You can watch a ton of basketball and see, like, I think I'm seeing this, or it seems like this team always goes to X in this situation or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there's an opportunity to kind of fact check yourself and to find out what they are indeed good at and whether or not, you know, your eyes were, you know, were telling you the right thing or not. So that's kind of, I mean, it's what I'm trying, when I try to do the, you know, I mean, a lot of what I do is also just, you know, write jokes, and that's super fun, and I love that. But when I try to sort of branch out a little bit, a lot of it is, all right, well, what did I watch last night? You know, what did I rewatch this morning? And then what can I learn about how that actually, you know, like, how did that bear out statistically, you know, for this team, for this individual player? You know, where are they successful, where are they not? The Lakers-Nuggets game last night was a really good example of that, because going into that game, you're saying, all right, we know that LA's on the second night of a back-to-back. We know that they're playing in Denver, and teams hate playing in the altitude of Denver, especially, you know, if they've been sort of on a road trip. And we know that Denver's really good in transition, and that the Lakers are terrible at defending in transition.
Yeah.
So we kind of know what to look for, and then you're watching the game, and you're going, oh, yeah, this absolutely 100% plays into that. You know, not only a statistical narrative, but, like, what we have seen with our eyes watching these two teams. But you had a better idea of what to expect and what to try to – how to sort of explain it to people.
Yeah.
And that's kind of – I feel like that's the sweet spot we need to hit. And it's – I mean, I'm not nearly as far along in that as I'd like to be, but I think that's kind of where I want to go.
Speaking of the Lakers – you write for a prominent basketball blog. I write for a pretty decent basketball blog, and we have to write about the Lakers a lot. Is there a certain point where you just get fatigue about that subject, and you think, if I have to write one more Lakers story about them disagreeing with each other, I'm just gonna like bang my head against the wall?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's been like an ongoing joke this whole season, right? Like,
yeah.
There's really, I mean, you know, the TVJ guys have done a wonderful job with that, of being like, every time we talk about the Lakers and while they're under 500, we're going to put money in a swear jar,
right?
Because it's the only way to make it relevant and interesting, because it's still, we're talking about a sub 500 team that has the same problems or very similar problems now that they had at the beginning of the season when they didn't play so well. So yeah, the hard thing is figuring out, like, I have no problem doing the, like, the he said, she said, backbody things, because that's all so ridiculous, and I, like, a big part of what I do with that stuff is just really steer into the skid of how dumb and ridiculous it is, and then make little jokes about it, which is really my bread and butter. That's where I go, is dumb little jokes. But when it's time to talk about why they're struggling, then it's like, yeah, I've written that, or we've written, you know, the guys that I write with, Kelly's Wire and Eric Freeman, we've all written the explanatory posts on why the Lakers aren't playing as well as they might like about a billion times. And I also have a lot of other people on every other site, and, you know, people talked about it on radio and on TV and everywhere else. It's like, it's difficult to, you know, continue to sort of recycle the explanation as to why a team with this much talent isn't playing so well. But, so yes, I mean, when you have those, Dwight and Kobe are fighting articles to write, then you're like, okay, well, this is whatever, but it's also not the reason they're struggling. They're struggling because they can't defend anybody in transition, they can't stop anybody on the perimeter, and Howard's not athletic enough or healthy enough right now to defend the rim the way they need to.
Bang.
Yeah. And you're like, you know, you're like, okay, so that's the graph that I'll put in after three paragraphs of, you know, here's how everyone's mad. And then you're like, this doesn't really matter, here's the real problem, and maybe they'll figure it out. All right, move on.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something that's actually interesting. But people, you know, I mean, we can argue it all we want, and there's like that weird sort of snake eating its tail thing of, are people reading about it because we're writing it, or are we writing about it because people want to read it?
Right.
But when it's the Lakers and it's those sort of celebrity people, then
it's kind of both.
Yeah, people want to read it. You know, I mean, So, you know, the best you can do is try to make fun of it and then offer an explanation and then, you know, get out and go about your day.
Yeah, there was one point in November where Dwight was really struggling with free throws, and not that he's turned it around, but I mean really struggling, and it was like a new thing for LA because Shaq hadn't been there in a while, so that was kind of like the focus. And I think there was like an 11-day period where I wrote about free throw shooting with the Lakers like four times, and after the fourth one, I was like, I never want to write about shooting free throws ever again. Like, this just there's no way this is interesting.
Right. There's a reason, generally speaking, that SportsCenter and other shows and other highlight things lead with the dunk as opposed to the missed free throw.
Yeah,
right?
Like, they might throw that in late in a game, but not often.
Right. Or say, you know, like a night last night where Howard went 3 for 14. It's like it might be a montage of clanks, perhaps with fun sound effects. But yeah, I mean, people, like, it's only interesting. What I've come to learn about the free throw thing is that people generally only care when it's the worst free throw attempt you've ever seen, or at least the worst free throw attempt you've seen this week. When DeAndre Jordan just starts airballing free throws, or Dwight does that, or the kid college kid that I can't remember but threw it like, you know, a foot and a half short, or someone throws it just like smack off the backboard.
Yeah.
That's when people care about free throws.
Yeah.
But not really so much in any other context. But yeah, it's like, there's how many times can you write about how Dwight Howard isn't good at free throw shooting? Like,
yeah.
And how many ways can you, like, unless there's a new angle to it, which is, you know, he is trying a different motion, or he's taking a step back, he's taking a step forward, he's trying a different, positioning on the line. And even that, you're talking about where a guy puts his feet in relationship to the foul line, like, you know, film at 11. It's hard to make it all interesting, but where nobody would read that post if it was about, I'm sorry, not nobody, because you and I would, if it was about Nikola Pekovic and the Minnesota Timberwolves, when it's Dwight Howard and the Lakers, it's like catnip for people. So it's weird, you know, you try to feed people that meal and then also hope that they stick around for the dessert, which is something else cool that you wrote.
I'm fascinated by this because recently Zach Lowe of Grantland has kind of fallen out of love with his favorite team, the Boston Celtics, and I feel like since I've gotten into writing, it's made me a better fan about the Timberwolves. Like in the sense that I'm more rational about them, because if I just tried to sell people on, hey, Michael Beasley's going to be a 40-point-per-game scorer 2 years ago, then I end up looking like an idiot. So I try to become as smart as I can about the team. You're a Knicks fan. You're a fan of a team people actually really care about and really like talking about. How has writing affected your fandom, if at all?
It's interesting. It's interesting. I've heard Zach talk about that, before about how it's, you know, since he's, I mean, he obviously is a very, he's a sort of, I'll say charitably to myself, he's a different kind of writer than I am, by which I mean significantly better. But he really approaches it like, you know, I'm rooting for the story, or I'm here to analyze, and I have, you know, he sort of has separated himself from that level of fandom. And that's, I think that's really admirable. It's not my experience with it. Like, it's made me, well, first off, watching the Knicks has long been a chore. It's long been a difficult process. But it's, I feel like having to write about the team that you are, that's your favorite team, and not doing it as a team blogger or like writing on a site that's specifically about your favorite team, but doing it, you know, trying to do it from a league-wide perspective, or, you know, once in a while as part of a larger national story for the league, it forces you to kind of have to back up what you're talking about more. Like, you can't just say, I hate that Jason Kidd can't shoot right now. You have to talk about why Jason Kidd's, you know, how, you know, the context for his shooting struggles, how that impacts the offense, why that screwed up the Knicks' offensive efficiency, which was like lights out over the first, you know, 26, 27 games, and it sort of come back to the pack a little bit, and why that makes Jason Kidd a real liability. If he's not hitting three-pointers from, you know, and facilitating the offense, then he's giving you nothing defensively, and it's a big part of their struggles in the backcourt. So you have to do that. You can't just be like, oh man, I wish Jason Kidd wasn't playing right now.
Right.
Like, you kind of have to do, you know, take a view of the larger picture, and then how that impacts the, you know, the Knicks in the context of the Eastern Conference, or, you know, what it means to their title chances, et cetera. It can't just be about my sort of venting my spleen about my team. Sometimes that's really, really hard. I think one of the harder things that I've had to write for Yahoo was right after the Knicks declined to match the Rockets' offer sheet on Jeremy Lin.
Yeah.
And that was, I mean, I had an emotional investment in that, like any Knicks fan did, and like a lot of, you know, just fans of the league had an investment in what Lin did for the Knicks last season and what that meant. And, you know, just like the energy that brought to a team that had really been without it for a long, long time. And I had an emotional investment in that. But then the job was to write about why they did it and why they didn't do it. Why they didn't want to bring him back, how it didn't make sense financially and from a roster perspective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And try to put that in context of like, well, even amid these arguments and, you know, the whatever reasoning that the Knicks say they have for it, here's why it's still not a, you know, like, you can't just say, I miss the guy that I like. You have to say, here's why this could still be a really problematic move, and talk about it from the financial perspective and, you know, who they have on the roster coming back at point guard and where they can go from there. Like, but writing that instead of just putting like a million curses in a line with James Dolan's name at the end of it, that's a more difficult thing to do. But it doesn't make that stuff go away in my head at all. Like, maybe sometimes it would be easier if it did, but it doesn't.
Yeah, you can't exactly just be Veruca Salt and be like, I want Jeremy Lin now. Like, you can't get rid of him.
Right, exactly. I mean, as much as I'll do that in the privacy of my own home, but I can't do that when I'm, you know, when the job is to write about like a big news story in the league. I can't just sort of get petulant about it as much as I'd like to. And as much as the Knicks have done that over the years, just get petulant about things that wind up being big news stories, I wasn't afforded the opportunity.
You recently, whether it was like a PR stunt or it was something he generally did, like J.R. Smith has been kind of a story over the last week for reasons a PR team wouldn't dream of. But you got to watch him like play basketball with children in Power Rangers recently. What was that like?
It was, I think, weird is a good start. I got an email the weirdest thing is I got the email from the people that are the PR folks for the Power Rangers, not from an NBA. Like,
naturally.
I don't know why they reached out to me, but they reached out to a number of people about it. But it wasn't through the NBA side; it was through the Power Rangers side, which was pretty hilarious. But
I love that they have a PR team.
Say again?
I love that the Power Rangers have a PR team.
I'm sure they have a pretty amazing one.
Yeah,
I mean, the fact of the matter is, there have still been stories written about them about 20 years after the fact.
Yeah.
So it's like they must be doing something right. But outside, obviously, of protecting the world from intergalactic threats. I mean,
sure.
They must be doing something right.
Sure.
I got this email offering, you know, hey, why don't you come down and watch J.R. Smith play basketball with the Power Rangers? And I said, yes, please, I'll be there, as soon as I can. And I got down there, and it's an odd environment to be in, because the entire premise of it is to paint J.R. Smith in a light that's like, sort of friendly and nice, and it's like him getting to play basketball with a bunch of kids, which he had just done during the half court of a recent Knicks game, halftime of a recent Knicks game. He'd run out and joined in the Knicks kids game out there and tried to get a shot off. So it was played off a recent news thing. It offered a good photo opportunity for him. And then there's also just 20 dudes dressed like the Red Ranger, like chilling. And that's barely, I mean, there was at no point like an announcement, like no one said, okay, and now here's what we're trying to do with all the Red Rangers. It was just sort of like, you guys stand in the background while J.R. Smith plays basketball with children. And so that's, I mean, it seems, it's like a weird dreamscape. But
sure.
My own idiot reptile brain kicks in as I'm on the way home, and I'm like, oh, I remember something about the Power Rangers that I can use to make an argument about J.R. Smith. And I did. That worked out okay. Like, J.R. Smith said that when he was a kid, him and his brother Chris would always argue about who got to be which Power Ranger, because they watched it growing up. And he said he always wanted to be he wanted to be the White Ranger, and because that guy had a sweet tiger that he rode in,
yeah.
And he was the leader and whatever. But he would settle on being the Green Ranger because his younger brother wanted to be the White Ranger, so he was being a good big brother and saying, you can do that. And then on the way home on the train, I remembered that those are the same guy, that the same guy played the Green Ranger and the White Ranger. And I spun that into a nonsense narrative about how the dueling natures of J.R. Smith are really evident through Power Rangers. And it went great.
Yeah,
I enjoyed
brilliant.
It. People seemed to like it. And there were pictures of J.R. Smith playing basketball with tiny, tiny children. So it worked out great.
What Power Ranger did you want to be? Because I wanted to be the Black Ranger simply because his name was Zach. And he, you know, that's the famous gif now of like him doing that like dance move before he gets into his fighting stance. Like, I always just wanted to do that before I got, like, if I was going to get in a fight, like, I would do like a break dance and then pop up and be ready to go, much like the Black Ranger.
I like that you say if, like, we both don't know that you don't do that regularly. You know, go out looking for street fights and then just do a quick little pop.
That's also how I get out of bed. I do a little spin and kick my legs up.
Right. I think that my memory of that is that I really identified with the Blue Ranger, who I believe his name was Billy, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, that
right.
sounds right.
Because that was the sort of like the nerdier guy with glasses, and that really hit a sweet spot for young Dan Devine growing up. Also, blue was the favorite color, so that sort of worked on a very basic level.
Okay.
Aspirationally, you know, I think in the initial sort of format of the Power Rangers, I would have wanted to be the Red Ranger because he was the leader in that situation, and he was sort of like the all-American quarterback kind of guy of the team. And I think every kid that is the Billy of his group wants to be the main guy.
Yeah, what was his name? Jason? It was Jason the Red Ranger, something like that?
That sounds right. I'm gonna trust you on that.
Okay. Before I let you go, I appreciate the time you have devoted this morning. How many songs have you listened to on JD and the Straight Shots album?
I wish I had a better bit for this, but zero. I refuse. Absolutely refuse to listen to James Dolan's Blues Project. I know they exist. I know that I've read articles about people going to the shows and like.
Have you not like seen the YouTube videos?
No, I know that they're out there,
wow.
And I refuse to check them out.
Wow, this is kind of an upset. I would have never guessed that.
We can only protest our favorite teams in so many ways. I'm not going to not watch the Knicks. I'm not going to not support the Knicks. I'm not going to not, I'm not going to avoid going to games or buying paraphernalia or things like that. But I can choose, thankfully, where in my apartment building, not to have cable vision. I can choose to have Verizon Fios. And I can choose not to, listen to his stuff on Spotify or watch the YouTube videos. So these are the small, silent protests that I'm able to make against James Dolan.
This is your favorite Knicks team since?
My favorite Knicks team since...
Because they're good, so you've got to get some enjoyment out of them, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. And especially like the beginning of this season was the first like month and a half was some of the most fun basketball I've ever gotten to enjoy. That month last year where they started playing around Lynn was probably my favorite bit of basketball I've gotten to watch since I was a little kid. But this Knicks team, front to back, is probably the best and most enjoyable Knicks team since Van Gundy left. And those teams weren't really super fun. They were grind them out kind of gross teams, but they were all like, they competed so hard and they worked together so well that was like a really fun thing to watch growing up as someone that, as a team sports model. But yeah, I mean, this is the most fun I've had watching a Knicks team since any team that had John Starks or Latrell Sprewell on it.
That's hard to argue with. Maybe the Rick Brunson years kind of coexist with that. I can't really remember the timeline, but Rick Brunson was always a favorite of mine, and I have no idea why.
I think that's the way a lot of Knicks fans felt. In my memory, Rick Brunson was always like the scrappy underdog that you were just hoping would hang on to a roster spot, and like. Now, if he got into a game, he was like the victory, the victory cigar. He was someone that you really supported in that way. So
yeah.
I have very fond memories of Rick Brunson, even if they're not very clear memories of what he actually did.
Absolutely. Well, Dan Devine, we can follow you at YourManDevine on Twitter. You can read balldon'tlie.com. Dan, thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
Zach, thanks for having me on, and I appreciate it.